Next up will be Dr. Diane Rowland, who's the Dean of the University of Maine's College of Natural Sciences, Forestry and Agriculture, and the director of, you can move over or step back. She's the also the director of the Maine Agriculture and Forest Experiment Station. So from the University of Maine, we really appreciate Dr. Rowland coming to share her expertise.
Well, thank you so much. I'd like to thank the chairs and the committee for allowing both myself and my colleague, Melody Neely, who's joining online, to talk to you today about primarily agriculture and forestry applications of gene editing. So I'm going to start out with giving sort of the general context of our discussion. I do not work in gene editing, but I'll give you my background in just a minute. Then Melody will follow on with some more of the details about the technology. So I have 20 years of research experience in plant and particularly crop research as a whole plant physiologist. I've started my career with the USDA Agricultural Research Service, went on to Texas A&M, and most recently was with the University of Florida. We're kind of a dinosaur science. There are many plant physiologists, but as a whole plant physiologist, we worked in the field and looked at traits at the whole plant level. And I've worked particularly with breeders and with geneticists. And I really liked Dana's comment about we're sort of the science that helps the tech not move ahead of the interpretation or the application. So we were there saying what the effects of those breeding technologies, gene editing could be for the function of the plant. I think some of the questions that have come up recently. I've worked with breeders both in castor oil seeds, potatoes, sesame, and most recently in peanut. So a lot of the general large plant, large crops. And again, I was focused on determining the physiological mechanisms behind those traits of interest and then helping breeders target those traits. And a lot of the work was focused on drought tolerance. And I have an opportunity now to sort of provide my take. We talk a lot about drought tolerance, but as a physiologist, this is an extremely complex trait. This is not just one thing that plants do. It depends on the severity of the drought, how frequently the drought event occurs. And so there's an extremely complex set of traits that plants use to respond to drought. And as a physiologist, I cringe every time we talk in the public sector about drought tolerance. We're going to provide drought tolerance. That's a very big lift. Many of the traits that we looked at are very specific in time and space. So what that means is there are particular traits that are very important for certain developmental periods in the crop itself. So really important during the early development. So those traits were important to target. Also in space. So this is in particular with either the architecture of the plant itself and how it photosynthesizes. For me, it was a focus on roots. And so how the roots explored the soil was very, very important. That means these traits are very complex. And the breeding for those traits is very laborious and very long. So to me, what gene editing means from an application standpoint is that we are accelerating that process. We're able to target particular traits that we know are very important in a much different way. So for me, when I went in, and we did research to understand the dynamic responses of roots. We now know roots don't sit there. That plant activates sections of roots at different times, depending on the conditions, depending on the developmental period of that crop. That's a really complex trait. And so then for somebody to go back and breed for that, that's extremely complex. So for me, gene editing means we can start to begin to target those particular traits that we know are important. I sort of think of CRISPR as akin to computer development. So, you know, the hardware came on, very rudimentary games came out, but people were like, what are we supposed to do with these computers? But then when you started having the applications, things exploded. So to me, as a crop physiologist, I kind of think of it in this way. We've made tremendous investments in genome sequencing. We know SNPs, or single nucleotide polymorphisms, which a lot of these traits now have been identified through. So we've made those really important investments in that information. Now, tying the information that we have for the traits that are important through gene editing, we can begin to see really the payoff of a lot of those investments. And we've convinced a lot of grower groups, a lot of farmer groups, that those investments in genome sequencing, for example, were really important. But this is a way to really deliver on that investment. So I think it's extremely important that Maine be in this conversation, for sure. We have particular crops that are essential, could really benefit essentially from this technology. Potato is absolutely one of them. We have researchers, unfortunately he couldn't join you today, but we have researchers who are working in this area on potato. But we also have the potential for blueberry. We think of blueberry more in the cultivated sense, not really what Maine has, which is very precious. But we're right now, we've established a new research center at the University of Maine, which is going to begin to take apart the different genotypes in a wild blueberry field. We know it's a mosaic of those genotypes. We're going to grow them individually and understand how they respond to drought and to heat. We know those climate changes are coming. And so then we're going to have that basic information about those genotypes and how they respond. So, you know, in the future, there certainly is that potential to use that information in gene editing. I will reiterate what's already been said a lot about the educational needs. Really, it first starts with a general understanding of the technologies. That's important for the public, period. We want to avoid the situation that happened with GMOs. And I really think a lot of that was because of just scientists not being good communicators. We didn't get ahead of it to help people understand what that technology was, what the risks were, certainly, what the limitations were. And so that's really key, that educational component. We also need to make sure that our workforce here in Maine is tooled up. They know the technologies, they're able to enter into industry, into education at many different levels. So that is really key to what we need to do. I will then pass it over to my colleague, Dr. Neely, who will give you more of the details.
Hi, thank you for allowing me to come today and talk with you. And I would like to share my screen. I have just a couple of slides that will kind of explain to you what we are doing now at University of Maine and what we foresee as possibilities of using this particular technique to benefit Maine. Let me start my... Okay, so we have already heard some of these ideas already in this panel, but as Dean Rowland just mentioned, potatoes is a huge money crop for Maine, and there are multiple publications out there talking about how CRISPR has already been used in potatoes, one of those in which has allowed it to be more resistant to blight, one of which allows, which changes the starch quality, so changing the nutritional value of the potato. Another study looked at herbicide tolerance. With blueberries is a major crop in Maine, and there's new research out there looking at cold tolerance. So this would be something really well received in Maine, being able to grow our blueberries longer. There's a study where they could actually change the regulating of the chilling dependence of flowering. So blueberries require this chilling temperature for the before they start flowering. And they changed a gene in which allowed those plants to go ahead and flower earlier. Another field that would be very well received and very beneficial to Maine is CRISPR-Cas in aquaculture. So aquaculture is a huge industry in Maine. There is a study right now in Norway where they have used CRISPR in salmon populations. So in Norway, they have both wild salmon and salmon farms. Those salmon farms have their farmed salmon kept in nets, but in wild waters. So of course, the big worry is that those salmon that have been genetically modified are going to escape and that that would harm the wild population. So they have now made a salmon species that is sterile so that if they escape, they cannot breed with the wild population and not change those genetics. They also have changed one of the melanin genes that makes it a slightly lighter color so that they can be easily spotted. However, if you make sterile salmon on your farm, you can't breed more salmon. So they have now taken that technique and done a quick reverse so that they can make sterile salmon that they keep within a tank in the lab to breed new salmon that are now sterile so they can release those. So these are all just ideas that could benefit Maine. I want to tell you a little bit about what we are doing at the University of Maine. And there are multiple researchers at the University of Maine who use zebrafish as a model organism. Zebrafish is a very tiny, about 1 inch long fish that we use. And we actually have CRISPR-Cas gene editing going on in the lab right now as we speak. We have graduate students and undergraduates doing CRISPR mutations. We are using it to look at how the immune system functions. We can change how an immune gene responds. We are looking at how genetic diseases like muscular dystrophy occur by using a zebrafish. Surprisingly, the zebrafish has an immune system that's almost identical to ours, which is kind of surprising. But because of that, we're able to address specific questions about how the immune system functions to change that in fish and make it more robust. So you can imagine that this research that we are currently doing in the lab could be applied to aquaculture and in those fish, making them more resistant to diseases, which is one of the major problems and economic problems with aquaculture right now. The next thing I wanted to address, and this kind of goes back to several of the questions that were addressed, brought up earlier in the discussion, is how do we work together using this new technique to make it a safe technique? So at Maine, we foresee it as this multidisciplinary research consortium. But we have a problem that needs to be addressed. We have blueberries that have a problem with disease. And so we have a design strategy that we make, and we are going to be using the gene editing using CRISPR to do that. To do that, we use our geneticists that have the tools and the techniques already to do that. We also need the bioinformatics. So once you make a change in a gene, you also have to ask, have I changed something else inadvertently? And so we can go back in and use bioinformatic and large data analysis to address that question. We can resequence those genomes and say, have we made any changes that we did not intend to make? There's also the possibility that when I remove this one particular protein, it changes how another protein might work. And so to do that, we have tools called proteomics. We can look at the different proteins that are made and how have those changed based on the change that we made. We can look at transcriptomics, which is the expression of other genes that might have changed based on the change that we made. We can use metabolomics, so we can see how the metabolism of an organism changes based on that one change that we made. Along with all of these, it's really important to then go into the agricultural testing. So University of Maine has a huge agricultural program in which they have farms, they have where they can actually plant these organisms. If we would make a change in a blueberry plant or a potato plant, and we could actually test that and see how well they grow, see how blight tolerant they are. We have food and nutrition analysis. Let's say we change something in a salmon and we want to make sure that the nutritional value is the same or it has the same texture or the same flavor. We also want to work very closely with the bioethicists and the animal welfare people to make sure that what we are doing is ethical and that is going to be accepted by society. So by having this consortium of researchers, we can make sure that we are producing a final product that is not only safe, but is also a great benefit to Maine and the industry. My last two slides are really, really basic technical slides, and you might not be interested at all in these. This just shows a really simple diagram of what CRISPR is. So as opposed to the GMOs where you're putting in using another, usually a virus, to put another gene in there that is not part of that organism. CRISPR basically takes your targeted DNA. This is a piece of double-stranded DNA. This is the gene we want to target. And it uses this RNA that just has that little piece of a gene. And it uses this big enzyme called Cas9. And this guide RNA comes into this double-stranded RNA and finds it and base pairs with it. And when that happens, this enzyme then makes a double-stranded break. Often that's all that's needed for that mutation to occur. So if we look at, this is what I was just showing you, you have a break in the DNA, and so you've disrupted a gene, and that protein is never going to be made again. You've not inserted anything. It uses the regular DNA repair mechanisms of the organism that are already there to make that repair, but it does it in a way that is not like it was before. So it basically mutates it and makes it so it can't be made anymore. The other way that we can use CRISPR-Cas is to change a protein a little bit. Say you just want to change, Dr. Rowland talked about SNPs, which are usually like two or three nucleotides of DNA. You can change that, that changes the way a protein functions. And again, you make that double-stranded break, you put in this little tiny piece of DNA, and you go on and make a new protein that is part of the original organism. You can also change a regulatory factor. Think about a nutritional value. Maybe something makes vitamin B and you want that plant to make more of that. You can then actually add a transcription factor that turns on a gene that's already there in that organism, but you want it to be stronger. So it makes more of that. You can also do that with CRISPR-Cas. So again, you're just taking what's already in the organism and either amplifying it or deleting it.
And if I could add, Melody, if I could add to that real fast, USDA considers that something that could have happened in nature. Yes. So that's why it's not regulated like it is for GMOs.
Thank you very, very much, Dean Rowland and Professor Neely. Terrifically important to understand how this technology can impact and be a tool for our agricultural and fisheries sectors.
And we didn't get to forestry. And the reason is forestry here is primarily the natural regeneration of the forest. There are a few planted acres of timber species. So it has potential. There are certainly ornamental species, other sorts of harvestable trees that's possible. But for our particular Maine forestry industry, it's probably more limited, but still the potential, especially for disease or pests, is huge.
If I could add one more little comment, as a professor, I would be remiss if I did not add this. As I mentioned, our students are, and our grad students and undergrads are currently working in the labs right now on these techniques, which means we're educating them and training them in skills that they can go out now into biotech industries in Maine and apply those skills to benefit Maine.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Questions, comments, either from the virtual panelists or those physically here?
I have a
Dr. Ray?
Dr. Rowland, I have just a question about the landscape of gene editing technologies in the agricultural space. You know, coming from JAX, we understand that what we do in mice, we can put multiple alleles, we can do lots of CRISPR things, tagging things as reporters, all sorts of things. And we also run, obviously, a knockout gene consortium effort. How would you characterize the sort of agricultural genome engineering space? Is it one gene at a time? And especially in context of, and I appreciate your comment about complex traits, because we know many of the things we see are complex traits and we may be tinkering one gene at a time. So I think it would be good for the group to understand sort of where ag is relative to biomed use of genome engineering. Thank you.
So I hate to be a scientist, but it depends, right? So a lot of it depends on whether that crop's genome has been sequenced, how far they are. So tomato is very far down the road, right? Because just a lot of work has focused on those particular traits. I think also, sorry, as a physiologist, but it depends on how the crop deals with the stress or is resilient to some stress. If they have a very complex mechanism in which they do that, then they're probably farther down the road. So we're certainly not where human or animal studies are, but for crop species, we are making those investments, particularly with genome sequencing. And then, you know, I'll make a plug. We need way more physiologists to understand what traits are important. But so it depends on the crop. But there's definitely that push in all of ag.
Representative Hyman.
How do you see, what would be your vision of the pipeline for students to come into this as an industry and then where the industry takes over? You know, we've gone through that with CTE, you know, with career technical education and the trades through the community, you know, the high school and then community college and then into industry. And, you know, in my neck of the woods, there's Pratt and Whitney and there's the Portsmouth Navy Shipyard, and all of that has taken a long time to develop, but it's there now. How do you see that in this industry?
So for students, I think what Melody has laid out, we have that at the university. I'm sure other universities have that sort of pipeline of where they're being exposed to the technology at various levels and getting that hands-on, even the mentorship where they see scientists using it, they see the results. I think that's really critical to getting the experience to actually do the techniques. So I feel like we have those pipelines certainly at the University of Maine. I think what I want to do as a dean is actually make those partnerships with the industry much stronger during that academic experience. So how do we get industry to be mentoring our students more? I know that that's done in some units quite a bit, but we need to strengthen that. I think also not just the biotech industry, but then where they hear from ag industry representatives as well, how those skills could be used at the bachelor level, the master's, the PhD level. So I think for me, what really needs to be done is that we need to partner as much as possible with the industry to make sure that that pipeline is straight for students. Melody, I'm sure you have some thoughts on that.
So I totally agree. We do have internships set up with our students that are in our program. So a lot of our students do go to JACS for internships in the summer. They go to MDIBL, they go to IDEX, they go to Jackson Labs. So I think it would be great if we could have more types of internships with more agricultural biotech companies that could expand on these skills so that these students are not only have the skills when they leave here, but they already have the experience of how those skills are being applied in real world situations.
And I think it goes beyond internships to as well. So bringing those professionals into the classroom,
yes,
advising students so that they, you know, they take them on when they start and they're helping them through that path all the way so that the student is really exploring all the potential.
No, so who owns these conversations? How does this happen?
For students, I think it's the connections that we have with the industries in the state between the university, certainly at my level, at the unit level, faculty level, those conversations and what the industry needs, then our conversations with our students coming in, what do they need? What do they value? So I don't think anybody owns those. It's meant to be a very open community discussion. So that's why I welcome this opportunity to come and hear from you. What should we be doing? Because education is evolving at the university level for sure. And we need to stay relevant and to make sure that we're serving the state. So here, especially in this state, it seems to be a very open conversation.
And I think the last question go to Senator Claxton.
I just wanted to thank you for whatever your contribution was to having the university recognized as such an exemplary, for recognizing the university to be as exemplary as in research. So whatever your contribution was, that thank you. My other question was about respect to infrastructure beyond people and dollars. What's needed to do this kind of work? I assume water, electricity.
Yep, equipment.
Yeah.
Yeah, space, all of those things. And the difficulty is that technology from the research standpoint is evolving just as quickly. And so making sure that we are maintaining up-to-date technology for our students and there, but also from the research standpoint. So yes, it's an expensive undertaking, but again, very critical. And I think the payoff is huge.
Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Dean Rowland and Professor Neely. If we have questions, I assume we can reach out.
Absolutely.
Okay, terrific. Okay, at this time, we're going to break for an hour-long lunch period. Unless anybody has any urgent questions, comments. All right, so it's 12, we'll call it for 1:05 for reconvene.